Special thanks to NBC Universal. The Breakfast Club is available for purchase digitally or via Blu-ray DVD. This is a Hot Pie original.
The Meyer Chronicles, take one. Welcome to The Meyer Chronicles, a Hot Pie Media production. For more information about The Meyer Chronicles, go to hotpiemedia.com. In this episode, Andy Meyer and John Rubin discuss the making of the classic 80s film, The Breakfast Club. This is part one of two.
Hi, everyone. My name is Andy Meyer. Welcome to the Meyer Chronicles. And I want to introduce my good friend. Say hello, John.
Andy, it is a pleasure to be here with you. And thank you for including me in the Meyer Chronicles. You know, you've had over 30 plus years as an industry executive, a producer, and of course, now an educator. And I love your background from A&M Films. So I know you're a music guy, but you're also a visionary. You're an instinct guy. And of course, The Breakfast Club, which is why we're here today, developing and executive producing The Breakfast Club. And this is great that it's part one of two parts. So I know the first part here is really the making of The Breakfast Club. And of course, the second part, we'll be talking about the marketing of the film and really the cultural relevance of that film all these years later. Of course, Andy, we met when I was producing a two-hour documentary on the making of The Breakfast Club for the network Reels in their Behind Closed Doors series. So that started airing in 2020, and you can still find it. It's on there, either on the Reels network or on their app. They have a great series about the making of legendary films, and it was really cool that they considered The Breakfast Club to be one of them. And of course, that led me to you. And of course, here we get to dig in a little further, which is really great. So if you want to give me a little overview, Andy, about your time in the late 70s, early 80s at A&M Records in California, and exactly what made you say, you know what, we need a film department. How did you convince your bosses to create something called A&M Films?
You know, you use an expression, which I'm proud of, that I'm an instinct guy. And, you know, everything I've done, I don't ask anybody's opinion. I don't do research. I don't do analytics. And when I was in the record business at A&M Records, which was a $100 million company, we were getting killed because every other studio was the top five albums were soundtracks because Warner Brothers Pictures would give their soundtracks to Warner Brothers Records. And A&M Records was an independent company. So nobody was giving us soundtracks because we weren't making movies. So I said, why don't we form a film company? I mean, I just was driving to work and I said, well, if we want soundtracks, we have to make movies. And if we're making movies, we need a company. So I went to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss and Gil Friesen. And I said, we should be in the film business. And they said, huh. Because they were really record guys. They didn't see themselves as film guys. And this is a true story. They said to me, well, why don't you find somebody to run A&M Films? And I contacted a few people who were producers and stuff and had to meet Herb and Jerry. And then they called me back and they said, you know, we don't know these guys in the film business. So why don't you run it? Because when we get screwed, at least you can tell us how we got screwed. With these guys, we'll never know where all the money went. So I said, okay. I'd never been on a movie set. I was an English major, and now I was running A&M Films.
I love that story, and I also love the photos, actually, that you provided to us of yourself as an exec at A&M. You got the big, you know, the Hollywood look. You got, a cigar, the big wooden desk. It's very, like a boss, you know. It's very cool. It's nice to have a visual of what that looked like, almost like out of a, you know, a TV, a movie or something.
You know, it was the early 70s was when I got there to A&M Records. And it's because I was producing concerts in college. But when I arrived, I had a secretary. I had an office. I was a director of college promotion. I was 21 years old. They gave me a black American Express card with unlimited credit. They gave me a car allowance of $500 a month. And I was so naive, I went to the car dealership and I said, this company just gave me a car allowance for $500 a month. What can I get? And the guy's like, oh yeah, we can get you a car. And it's exactly $500 a month. And I said, okay, that's how it works. So that was really the crazy sex, drugs, and rock and roll time of the early 70s. And I sort of was there through 1976. Then I took a year off sabbatical and I traveled the world, which is sort of a whole other podcast. And then I thought, let's do a film company. And that's how A&M Films started.
So it's 1981, A&M Films is born, but you guys have no films yet. How did you go about deciding what would be the first thing A&M Films would find, create, and then release?
Well, we were fortunate in that we had a very well-respected agency, CAA, and some top agents who started sending us stuff because we were buyers. We were financing screenplays. And a lot of producers don't finance screenplays, and so they don't really get the material that we got. But I discovered a book in a bookstore called Birdie, and we spent about a year on the script, and eventually I thought it was ready. And so we went to TriStar, we cast Nick Cage in it, Matthew Modine, and out of the box, we had our first movie, which won the grand jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival. So that was the first movie. In the case of The Breakfast Club, that was something that came out of nowhere because I was just reading writing samples because I was looking for some good comedy writers. And this agent, Tony Ludwig at CAA, who was one of my agents, gave me a script called Vacation, which I thought was the funniest script I ever read. And I called up Tony and I said, who is this guy? He's great. Let's do something with him. And he said, well, we don't really know him. He's in Chicago. He's in the advertising business. And we just sold this script. We just signed him. And I said, I want to meet him. And I was in John Hughes' house the next day. And there's some teachable moments from this encounter I had with John Hughes, because he not only had the Breakfast Club script for me, he had marketing plans and advertising posters for his next five movies, 16 Candles, Mr. Mom, Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He was going to sell me something. If I didn't buy The Breakfast Club, he was going to sell me something else. But he had written The Breakfast Club, but he said there's going to be a problem. I said, what could be the problem? He said, well, I have to direct it. And I didn't know if he knew which way to hold the camera. And I said, okay, let me read the script and then we'll talk. And so I went back to my hotel. I read it. I thought it was fantastic. I called up Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss and I said, we have to buy this right now. It's another Instinct thing. I said, this is going to get around town and whoever reads it will buy it. And they said, okay. And so we bought it and gave it an independent film budget of $1 million. And we were sort of on our way to making our second movie. And all this was happening really fast because I'd never been on a movie set, only developed a couple of scripts, and we were kind of on fire. John Hughes didn't just write screenplays. He wrote stories that he knew how to market. You know, there are a lot of writers, they're just writing scripts. They're just writing a bunch of scripts. And even with my students, I say, well, who's your audience? And they go, I don't know. I just want to do it. You know, it's like, it's a fun idea. And he was so prepared for my meeting that really impressed me and kind of convinced me that I thought he could direct.
What was it about that script, though, specifically The Breakfast Club, that grabbed you? You said you read it in your hotel room that night. Obviously, I know you said you called the bosses back in LA that we got to get this. But what was it about the script that you thought you had to have this?
So when I read the screenplay, at that time, you know, most of the teen movies were sort of beach blanket bingo, kids running around. There weren't really any serious kids movies. And I felt that this was not only a serious movie, but it was universal in that everybody has, you know, their own kind of shields that they put over themselves to protect themselves. And in The Breakfast Club, those shields are peeled away and we see who these people really were. And I thought that was amazing. But the most impressive thing, and I talk about this in my writing classes, in theory, when you're telling a story in the first 20 pages or 20 minutes, you're supposed to get the plot going and introduce your main characters. John did that before the movie even started. He had Anthony Michael Hall's voiceover gave you the plot.
Saturday, March 24th, 1984. Shermer High School. Shermer, Illinois.
And watching the kids arrive to go to detention.
Can't believe you can't get me out of this.
You want to miss a match? You want to blow your ride? Now, no school is going to give a scholarship to a discipline case.
Is this the first time or the last time we do this?
Last.
Well, get in there and use the time to your advantage.
Mom, we're not supposed to study. We just have to sit there and do nothing.
Well, mister, you figure out a way to study.
Yeah.
You know exactly who they are. You know which stereotype they are. So when they sit down in the classroom, you've already done all the heavy lifting on plot and character, and you can go deeper into the characters right away. It just fast tracks the movie and gives it a lot of momentum. And that's what I liked about it.
I think, you know, we had talked kind of like, you know, screenwriting 101. Sometimes if you get to that spot in a film by about the 15 or 20 minute mark, you know, that's par for the course. But here, it allows the movie to just be, you're in it from the second it starts, which is what grabbed me as a 12-year-old kid watching that in the theater. And I think what grabs people today is you're in it immediately. You know who these five characters are. And that's very valuable.
Efficiency and clarity are really important in writing. And a lot of people forget about that.
It is now 7:06. You have exactly 8 hours and 54 minutes to think about why you're here.
Can we talk a little bit about sort of, for lack of a better word, the balls that John Hughes had to say to you, yeah, you know, this is my story, and if you guys want it, you have to let me direct it as well. He was that confident, or was it that he was so precious over his creation?
He was that confident. You know, he became so hot between Mr. Mom, which he wrote, Vacation, and he was a music fanatic. And the only mistake we made with John Hughes is he wanted us to give him a record label, and we said no. Because we just committed to him directing. We didn't know if he could do that. And Herb and Jerry thought I was crazy to bring up, also give him a record label. This guy who's never done anything. We're going to give him a label and let him direct. So, and he probably would have been fantastic because he had a great sense of music, which I'm sure we'll get to. But he had, he was very charming, very Midwest kind of soft-spoken, very, very honest, a straight shooter. And those are all the qualities you need to be a good director, I think.
And you said how prepared he was for the meeting, but I also like the fact that it's pretty obvious that the way The Breakfast Club is constructed as a story, it was actually originally called Detention before even you saw it, Andy. And it was really, he wrote it like a play. I mean, he knew this is one room, this is essentially five characters. So it's very easy. I think his logic, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think his logic was that, well, so, you know, the only way someone's going to let me direct something for the first time out is if it's simple, manageable. Is that something that he was selling to you? Did you feel that that was something he brought up that day?
He made it clear that he wrote this in a way that would convince us that he could direct it. It's one room, couple of characters, not expensive. You know, he was thinking as a producer as well, you know, budget. The movie ended up costing like $12 million, but we could have done it for $1.5 million.
Well, that's the thing. You've got $1 million. So for you guys, I like that, you know, you've told me that's small potatoes for A&M, right? That's just a number you sort of picked out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a, you know, $100 million company. So it's a pretty small investment for you guys. From his perspective as this, whatever, you know, late 20s, early 30s, new guy to the film industry, $1 million deals, probably like he just landed in gold, you know?
Here was a guy who never directed, talking to a guy who's never produced a movie or been on a movie set. So the two of us were kind of like innocent children in this room. He was saying, let me direct. Like, how would I know how to judge whether he could be a director or not? He didn't have a reel. I mean, I didn't even know the basic tools that you would look for in selecting a director because I arrived 20 minutes into A&M Films. So the idea that we were both naive and both kind of unaware how naive each of us were, now that I look back on it, and the fact that somebody would give us money, an English major and a ad guy, and it went from $1.5 million to $12 million in like 2 months.
So we're going to talk about how it went from an indie film to a big budget film, of course, Universal Studios, once they came in. But let me just ask you, with $1 million, what were you envisioning this movie was going to be? And what was that process like of beginning to cast the film? And I know you were going to Chicago a lot with John. What was the indie version of The Breakfast Club going to look like?
Well, you're right about one thing. I just pulled $1 million out of the air. We didn't do any budgets. I didn't even know how to do a budget. We just said, oh, small movie, $1 million. Herb and Jerry, they weren't really movie guys, and $1 million wasn't much for them. So they said, okay, if you think the script's good. So we started to cast it in Chicago, and John wanted to shoot it in Chicago, and we thought that was a good idea. He was a real family guy. we thought it would be better for him to be in Chicago at home than have him come to L.A. and get into that whole L.A. lifestyle. It didn't seem to fit him as a Midwesterner. And then I got a call from a man named Ned Tannen, who became a very good friend of mine. And he said, "We hear you're making the Breakfast Club." And I said, "We are, for $1 million. He said, "We'd like to give you 12 for it." And again, I didn't know much, you know. I'm thinking 1 million, 12 million. I said, "Ned, we'll take $12 million for this movie. We'll partner." So we partnered on the movie.
You would have taken 5 million, 6 million.
Yeah, I mean, I would have taken anything. And that was a company called Channel Productions, I think. And they agreed it should stay in Chicago. But we moved the casting to L.A. also. And we started to, you know, there are all kinds of stories about how John discovered Molly Ringwald from a photo that he sees and things like that. And we cast it pretty well. It was probably the easiest movie I ever made, ironically, since it was my first, because everybody went to work at the same place. By letting John direct, what Universal made sure was going to happen is they put the best people around him, like a great DP, one of the best editors ever, named Dee Dee Allen. And everybody went to work. It was like a 9-to-5 day. When we got the cast together, one of the brilliant things we all agreed on, I don't take credit for it, is we had the actors stay in a hotel together for like 3 weeks while they were rehearsing in Chicago. And the reason we did that was so that they got to know each other so well that when they arrived, they would have sort of the shorthand of kids who were in the same school together who knew each other, as opposed to 4 or 5 actors who, you know, come in and have to get to know each other. So all that worked out really well.
Claire?
Claire, it's a family name.
Oh, it's a fat girl's name.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk for a moment about John Hughes being such a music nut and a music aficionado. Is that the idea of you guys both being young and naive in his house, figuring out, okay, I guess you'll let me do this and I'll trust this guy. And neither, you know, both of you probably, you know, projecting that you were coming from a little bit higher level of experience than you maybe both really were. Mm-hmm. Which I love. And that's sometimes how the magic happens, actually. I think he was really impressed with you, as this is a guy from A&M Records who flew out to LA to my little house in wherever he was in the north suburbs of Chicago. Can you tell me a little more about how he was viewing A&M Records? I mean, this major label with all these stars and also some sort of young bands that he was in tune to as well. I think that was a big part of how he was impressed with you.
When we made the picture, John could have had any of our acts in the movie. You know, we had a huge inventory of acts, from Peter Frampton to Humble Pie, Joe Cocker. And John found this obscure band that we had just signed in London called Simple Minds. And of all the bands, he picked them. And I had never even heard their music before, and we had just signed them. So he went that deep into our catalog to come up with, you know, along with David Anderley, sort of the newest, hottest, and ultimately, that's why he probably should have given him a record label. I mean, that music has stayed around forever.
Yeah, all his soundtracks.
I hear it in elevators all the time.
Oh, yeah. I hear it on satellite radio. I actually heard it yesterday. Yeah, a song like that really, and we'll get to it, of course. But yeah, he had a crystal ball with a lot of the music that he was discovering in England before people in America knew it. Even the guys on the label side, like you said, who signed Simple Minds, probably still didn't really know who they were. During this window of time before it became the $12 million big budget film, I know you told me that he had said to you, you know, while we're working on this, hey, I just cranked out another script last weekend. You know, that's when he wrote 16 Candles over a weekend. Tell me a little more about, he was just cranking out content, right? He was just writing all the time.
I think because he was an advertising guy, he was used to being, you know, it's sort of like people who work on television shows. You know, they're either writing one, shooting one, or in post on one. And he was sort of that way about screenplays. He would literally, and I actually was in Chicago and have seen him do this, buy a case of Coca-Cola, a carton of cigarettes, go into his house with his family and on a Friday and on a Monday, have a script. It's like he's an ad guy on Deadline.
That's funny. I think they said Ferris Bueller was kind of written the same way. And yeah.
And he never took notes, and he never really did rewrites. I mean, he got input from the actors, but a studio would never like say, hey, let's change the ending on this script, John. he never sought anybody's advice. He just wrote a script, put it out there, moved on to the next one. So he is confident.
And of course, once Michelle Manning, who was working with Ned Tannen at Channel, once she got a hold of the 16 Candles script, that's of course when Ned finds out, you know, he's got The Breakfast Club, this amazing script ready to go. He's got 16 Candles. And now he ends up with a two-picture deal with Universal Studios. He gets to direct both these movies. What was the studio's logic of which one he should do first?
He has a two-picture deal. He's never directed. He wanted to run a record label, talking about confidence. And we talked to Ned about it, and there was a lot of nervousness at Universal about The Breakfast Club. It didn't really have a marketing plan around it. It wasn't something they could just put into the system and put out in 4,000 screens. They thought 16 Candles was much closer to the kind of beach party teen movie and would be easier for them to sell, and then they could sort of have more time to figure out what to do with The Breakfast Club. So we all agreed that 16 Candles would go first, although John thought he was going to direct The Breakfast Club first. He was kind of surprised that it got switched. He didn't complain. I don't think he ever did a demo reel or anything. He just went out and shot a movie.
But like you said, he really, he benefited from Universal surrounding him with the right people, from casting directors to production designers. And we're going to get into that in a second. But I think, you know, you guys had some blind faith, but tell me, I mean, Ned Tannen was really smart to say, I'll take this chance with young upstart talent, but I'm also going to surround him with really good people. So I feel like that probably relaxed you guys, that there was always someone on set to kind of make sure it went the way it was supposed to.
And Ned was the president of Universal and very well respected. And he ended up being my neighbor, actually. But he was able to just pick up the phone and get whoever we wanted for the movie. That's such a important difference than, you know, having John Hughes pick the editor. You know, we gave him Dee Dee Allen, who, if people don't know her, she's one of the pioneers of editing. She came up with the sequence for Bonnie and Clyde at the end where they're killed in a slow motion shootout. And I ended up doing two movies with her, and she was just an enormous influence on John Hughes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon. She'd edited Reds in the early 80s, just before The Breakfast Club. So they were so lucky. You guys were so lucky to get her, because some of the way that movie is written is amazing, but also the way it's cut. If you watch it, it is pretty amazing how she intercut all the looks and the reactions. It developed the characters without really saying anything.
People don't really appreciate how important an editor is in any kind of storytelling, but in comedy in particular, because you can write a really funny script, but from a directorial point of view and an editor's point of view, if you don't hold on the reaction shot long enough, if you don't cut to the establishing shot, it just takes the air out of the balloon for a comedy. So she was really, I give her so much credit for the comedy and the intense drama in the film. The scene where they're all sitting around the talking head scene was really an editing masterpiece, I think.
You want to know what I did to get in here? Nothing. I didn't have anything better to do. You're laughing at me.
No!
Yeah, you are.
One or two other people that I think are critical to the success of the film, who Ned put on this film to kind of make sure that all the ships were running on time. You want to tell me about the set designer?
The reason why they wanted $12 million was they wanted to build the library from scratch. Because if you're shooting a movie in one room, that room gets pretty dull after a while if you're just staring at an old library with some books. So they created this sort of contemporary, hip library, and they had the advantage of having the script. So if you've got the script before you build the library, you know that you've got to have a balcony for them to be dancing. You've got to have a place for Judd Nelson to fall through the roof. So that's really where the $12 million went. They found an abandoned school in the suburbs of Chicago and took over the gym and built the library.
I actually saw when we were doing the Reel special through NBC Universal, the making of The Breakfast Club, you know, I was able to see production photos and really the architect designs of how that gym turned into the library at Maine North High School in Des Plaines. And it's just, it's kind of amazing, the foresight. I mean, you would have had a boring, smaller library that didn't have cool blue neon lights, and every scene would have been probably the same point of view because you wouldn't have had that depth and the different spaces of the library to make it look like it wasn't all filmed in one room.
And the statue,
oh, of course,
the famous statue that Judd Nelson hangs on and Ally Sheedy throws bologna at, except Ally Sheedy couldn't hit the statue, so it was Michelle Manning who ended up throwing the bologna. Little known trivia of The Breakfast Club.
That's funny. And actually, I can add one more piece of trivia to that is the director of photography, the wonderful Tom Del Ruth, who also, you know, very accomplished, went on to do The West Wing and a lot of other wonderful things in film and TV. Tom Del Ruth said that some of those guys on set, they had a bet how many times it would take Michelle to throw the bologna on the statue before it would stick. And a few of the production guys, they said, oh, this will take 20 or 30 times. And I think it was on the second or third time it stuck. So somebody lost $10 over that. Yeah, I love how you've explained to me back when we first met, and you're explaining it here. They created this beautiful set around the script. And explain how normally it's the other way around.
Well, it can happen either way, but you don't usually build a set that way. I mean, you have a screenplay and then you go look at locations. So the uniqueness of the thinking was, well, let's just not do a location scout and find some library somewhere. Let's build it exactly the way we want so that we have all the tools we need to shoot this film properly. Instead of making adjustments and cutting away from a side of a shot because that is really dull in this old library. Everything was designed for clarity is the word I would use.
What's funny also is, you know, that school, Maine North, was basically unused the previous year. It had actually shuttered its doors because the student population that they anticipated never made quota. So this, it really looks more like a prison if you see the outside of it. And currently today, it actually is a police station.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's very fitting that these kids were trapped in this building. And I think that's part of what John Corso and Michelle Manning and certainly John Hughes, what they loved about the outside of the high school is that it, you know, was this cold, hard edifice that looked like the last place in the world you'd want to spend your Saturday.
Detention.
Exactly. It's the worst place to be.
I know it's detention, but I don't think I belong in here.
You know, when we talk about the studio wanting 16 Candles to happen first, which in hindsight, can you tell me why that was the right move? Because, of course, while The Breakfast Club's filming, 16 Candles comes out and actually is a pretty big hit.
Well, this was all kind of good for us in a way that we couldn't predict. You have to keep in mind, I was so new, I don't really think I had the skills to think about the marketing plan and the timing of the release of Breakfast Club. But John, after 16 Candles and writing Mr. Mom and Vacation, John was so hot, it just made us even hotter. So in a way, without our planning it, letting John become so popular and everybody wanted to see his movies and everybody wanted him to direct and write. And now we had his next movie. And it just brought all the best people to the movie, and it built up such momentum for us, and we needed it because we knew it would be a hard movie to sell. So that's how it worked.
I remember you had said to me that, you know, it was one of those sort of, you know, moments where, you know, the stars line up perfectly and, you know, lightning strikes more than twice, where everything he does turns to gold. And then you guys really were just part of that gold. You were on the train.
Yep.
On the John Hughes train.
We just jumped on that train and
look at it this way. I mean, I know I asked you this because I'm fascinated from the timeline of it. And again, from a movie fan and a pop culture guy, you know, when I look at the summer of 1983, aside from being a 10-year-old kid at summer camp, I also know I saw Mr. Mom and Vacation in the theaters. I didn't know who wrote it. I didn't know who John Hughes was, but those were huge hits that summer. And that's as you guys were still developing this before even casting really The Breakfast Club. So for people at home to realize the name John Hughes meant a lot at that point. And then when 16 Candles comes out in May of 84, Breakfast Club is just wrapping shooting. So it really is right on top of each other. And the momentum, you didn't plan it, but the momentum of it was perfect.
Well, he became a brand like Disney. So anything that had John Hughes's name on it, everybody wanted to see. And we had that next movie, The Breakfast Club.
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
For that real special, I was able to interview Jackie Birch, who is the casting director also for 16 Candles. And plenty of other great films, a lot of John Hughes films. Jackie told us so much about finding Judd Nelson to play John Bender was, you know, like the cross she had to bear. She was pulling people off the streets in New York City based on their look and then would say, you know, can you act? I love that visual. And then Judd Nelson, of course, you can't picture John Bender being anybody else, but you know, I know the studio did get a little nervous at one point before shooting was going to commence. And they tried to see if they could actually snag Nicolas Cage to be Bender at the last minute because they needed one of those actors to have a name, which right. I find amazing. Could Nicolas Cage have been John Bender in your eyes?
No. And I did a movie with Nicolas Cage when he had hair.
Sweet. You couldn't ignore me if you tried.
That's part of the nervousness that they had was they had a brand in John Hughes, but they didn't have any name actors that anybody knew very well. And so why would people go see this movie? Because people usually go, they would go for a John Hughes movie, maybe. But people normally, on a little character movie, there's a couple of names in there that you like. And so you go see it because you've liked their movies before or something. So, you know, there are huge marketing problems coming up for us.
And before we get further into those, I do want to touch upon the 3-week rehearsal period you mentioned, which was also critical to that rapport that the actors had. You know, so they're all staying at the Westin O'Hare in Chicago, and John's rehearsing them daily like a play. So tell me a little more about, you know, I really love how you really explained to me once before that it really was like they were already students together in the class when on the first day of shooting. Give us a little more about that.
John wanted to get a shorthand between the actors so that they would be more naturally connected or disconnected, depending on who the character is. And so he had them stay at the hotel, rehearse with him every day. I think he got some pretty good notes on the script from the actors and changed them a little bit. And it created kind of a team spirit, I think, would be the best way to describe it. So that they all just didn't arrive getting off planes the next day and go on the set and meet the actors for the first time. And it was a smart move for John, since he'd never directed before 16 Candles, to be this intimate with the actors and spend so much time with them and be so focused. And the script and the movie physically was not difficult to make. So, I mean, he did the right thing by working on the characters and their dialogue and performance.
You wear tights?
No, I don't wear tights. I wear the required uniform.
Tights.
Shut up.
And there's one cool thing. I know as the script drafts were changing, you told me a funny story that there was a window of time where you saw whatever draft, you had chatted with John, you gave him a little bit of information about something specific. And then the next time you saw the draft, something that you told him was actually incorporated into the film.
When John handed me the screenplay in his house, there was one blank in the screenplay. And it's in the talking heads scene where they sit around for 20 minutes and sort of reveal what they actually were in detention for. Anthony Michael Hall, the reason why he's in detention was blank. And we were talking about high school days because we were similar in years in some ways. And I told him that I failed shop.
You failed.
And it's the worst thing that I could have done for my parents, because in CHOP, you had to make a lamp and you had to pull the string and have the light go on. And if the light doesn't go on, you fail the class. So I failed the class. And I just told him that. And then a couple of weeks later, I'm going through the script and I see that's the reason why Anthony Michael Hall tried to kill himself and is in detention.
I'm here because Mr. Ryan found a gun in the locker.
So that's my claim to fame for writing in The Breakfast Club, that I failed shop.
So Andrew Meyer, back in Harrison High School in 19, whatever, you fail shop. Your parents are probably a little more than disappointed.
Pissed off.
Pissed off. But it ended up becoming part of Hollywood lore.
Yeah, it's could be my greatest achievement in high school, actually. It's just the only thing people remember me for is the lamp, the guy who failed shop.
Some failing shop.
When the movie was edited and you saw the version that John was bringing to Universal, What did you guys think, and what were the hurdles that were going to be in marketing this film?
When the studio saw the film and they saw the 20-minute sequence in which the kids sit on the floor and reveal why they're really in detention, the studio thought it was way too long, way too serious. They thought audiences wouldn't want to sit and see this drama for 20 minutes on what is supposed to be like a comedy.
When you grow up, your heart dies.
They wanted to see if they could cut it out. And John and I were in shock and had to plead our case to have them keep that sequence in, which ultimately became one of the most important scenes in the movie by far.
Oh, God. Can you imagine The Breakfast Club without that scene? How does it end? How would they become friends or not friends? The movie's lost without it.
Well, they were really nervous about it. And you know, going into the release of it, that was their biggest concern, that 20-minute sequence.
You know, it's funny, you know, that sequence was actually a lot longer because John Hughes was known for overshooting. I think they filmed about 250,000 feet of footage on that scene alone. And Michelle Manning had said, you know, they just kept rolling to dig deeper and deeper for the actors to get even more emotional, more intense. Even Molly Ringwald has a 5-minute monologue while she's in detention, and that's not in the film. That scene is so important to the film, and I think part of it's because John shot it so many times. Can you see that in the actors' performances?
I think it's John's best directorial work and Dee Dee Allen's best work in the film, because that scene could have gone sideways 20 different times and it didn't. And it's a testimonial to John that he was able to get those performances. And up till then, the movie was not that emotionally complicated. And to be able to direct and edit an emotionally complicated scene with so many actors, it's not like it's just two people having a fight in a Starbucks. I mean, it's a bunch of people on the floor opening up to each other and with each other at the same time. And that's really hard to do.
It's amazing to think that it's the fall of 1984. You guys are trying to figure out how to market this movie, and you probably don't really have much of a plan yet. Andy, thanks so much for this podcast. It was a pleasure speaking with you. Great to hear all these stories. And I know fans of yours and fans of The Breakfast Club are going to enjoy this and many more to come.
Thank you, John. I look forward to doing another Breakfast Club podcast with you because you're like a fun guy.
Oh, hey, you too. Thanks. We had fun. All right. Thanks so much for tuning in to the making of The Breakfast Club as part of the Meyer Chronicles podcast series. And in part two, we're going to find out just how the movie did find an audience upon its release. And then for many years to come, how that audience grew and grew to a point where this is a movie that has cultural relevance almost 4 decades later.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Meyer Chronicles. And thank you for listening. To hear more episodes in this series, go to hotpiemedia.com.